From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The magazine Consumer Reports first came out in 1936 in the middle of the Great Depression. Every dollar counted. People needed to know what would last, what was good. They still do. In 2011, Consumer Reports is celebrating 75 years on the job. At the same time, Americans are thinking about consumption and where it takes us. This hour On Point, we'll talk with Editor-in-Chief of Consumer Reports, the Editor-in-Chief, and take your questions on what works, what you can trust, how we consume. You can join the conversation. Do you scour Consumer Reports before you make that big purchase? What's your question on how they test and assess? What's your product question right here, right now? What's best? Washer, dryer, smartphone, you name it. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we will talk with a champion of anti-consumerism who says it's time to refocus. But first, joining me now from Yonkers, New York, is Kimberly Kleeman, Editor-in-Chief at Consumer Reports, this year marking its 75th anniversary. Kim Kleeman, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
I wish you'd give us a little, Consumer Reports by the numbers here, by the numbers. I mean, how many people read? What do they do with it? Give us a kind of a number profile.
Okay, so you mentioned the number that we're proudest of this year, 75 years, started in 1936. We have 4 million subscribers to our print magazine. Mm-hmm. We have another 3.3 million subscribers to our website, making us the largest for-pay subscriber site in the world.
How much do you charge? There's a number?
We charge $29 for a web subscription. Mm-hmm. We charge $26 for a magazine subscription. We also have newsletters, health and money newsletters, any number of books. We have a sister magazine called Shop Smart. If you don't want to burrow down in all the research and just want the top stuff and what to stay away from, you'll go with Shop Smart. We buy everything we test. Our model from the very first days has been, you know, no money from advertising, no freebies from manufacturers. So subscribers support us.
You test 3,600 products and services a year. I'm reading in one report. I mean, how do you pay for all that? You're buying all those cars and washers and dryers and you name it. How do you cover all that?
Subscribers. So that is pretty much it. We get some money from donations, but it's mainly subscribers.
$182 million in revenue for your last fiscal year. That's pretty strong.
Yeah, absolutely. And we spend millions of dollars. We spend $2.5 million at least. That's just on the cars we buy every year, and several million dollars more on all the other products that we test. One of the biggest perks of working at Consumer Reports is that once we finish testing, mm-hmm. We auction off those products to our employees and their families. And that helps us recoup some of that money that goes back into buying, you know, future products.
That's interesting. But I suppose those auctions, given that they've just reviewed what's best, those should be pretty interesting index themselves, what they pay for different products of what's good.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm also reading here that, I mean, your love cannot be bought in the sense you don't take advertising. So if I'm Toyota or GM or you name it, I can't buy your love just by taking out lots of advertising. But you also don't let manufacturers, producers use your recommended list in their own ads or in their own public statements. That they can't say number one is recommended by Consumer Reports. Why not?
That's right. The reason is that we want people to know very clearly that we are working only for consumers. Consumers are our only constituents. The reason we don't take ads is that we fear that if somebody saw a nice big ad next to one of our ratings charts, they would begin to wonder, is this product highly rated because the manufacturer paid them for the ad, or what is the motivation behind how we're doing our rating? So we wanted none of that even perceived conflict of interest. So that is why we are purely subscription-based.
You've got a lot of people subscribing in print and online. How do you maintain your value to consumers in the digital age where there seem to be, you know, a million chat rooms and boards where people can talk about different products? Why is Consumer Reports important when I can go to an Amazon chat board or you name it and see what a lot of other consumers are reporting for their real-world experience?
people have told us time and again that there is still a need for an impartial arbiter out there. There are some products that I'll go with my friend's recommendation. What about, you know, popcorn or peanut butter? Yep. Or, you know, your friend might like the car he or she drives, but they might not know, for example, that that car is the least reliable one of the 80 that we've tested this year or the 300 we've tested in recent years. And so Consumer Reports provides a unique service still out there in the marketplace.
Now, when you go out and buy the products that you test, how do you know that the manufacturers aren't giving you like the very best of the production line, you know, like the perfect example of their product?
If we accepted freebies, that would very definitely be an issue. But we have secret shoppers throughout the country who go out and buy things on store shelves just as real consumers do. And they ship it back to our headquarters in Yonker where most of this stuff is tested. And that is how we ensure that we are getting the product that you are getting.
Because you're buying, sort of buying blind or buying secretly out there. They don't know where you're going to get it. So what do? I know you've moved into services as well, and we'll talk about that, but take physical products for a moment. How do you actually test them across the enormous array of sort of vectors and factors that would come into play?
Well, many products have voluntary or mandatory standards associated with them. So one of the things that we look at are, you know, what are the standards that are out there? And we often will test to the standard, but we also test beyond the standard. A consumer will use this product far more heavily or maybe in a different way than is governed by the standard. So we will test maybe to the failure of the product to find out, wow, you know, this is failing just beyond the standard, and we think that this product should be more durable. So that might be the angle in a story. There is no machine out there that can check how gloppy a chip gets after it's dragged through salsa. So we need to create that machine. Or one of my favorite early machines is our sock tester, where we wanted to see how easily it was for the heels and the toes to get scuffed up. And so we had to create our own machine out of kind of door handle parts. Anyway, it's a funky looking machine, and I just love the creativity that goes into that. I've interviewed some of our own testers on how did you come up with that? And one guy told me, you know, I can never figure it out during my workday, but when I go to bed, yeah, I dream about these machines.
The machine. So you must have a million. Did you say you really have one that tests how gloppy taco shell stuff gets when you drag it through the salsa?
Chips, yes. We have definitely tested that.
Wow.
We have a machine called Johnny Walker that tests treadmills. And we have another machine that tests all possible ergonomics of elliptical exercisers.
Oh, boy.
So it's an amazingly fun place to work because you poke your head in any lab and any number of tests could be going on.
Listeners, we have the editor-in-chief of Consumer Reports with us today in the 75th anniversary year of the magazine, now website, and all the rest. Kimberly Kleeman is here, and we're happy to take your questions on products, on consumption, you name it, any particular product. 800-423-8255 is our number, and Amy is calling from Queensbury, New York. Hi, Amy. You're on the air with the editor-in-chief of Consumer Reports.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good.
Good. I am an online subscriber, and I never make a large purchase or even a mid-sized one without first consulting Consumer Reports, so thank you very much for your services. However, I was wondering, being that we're in such a strict economy right now, and people are trying to make the best choices to heat their homes and things like that, will you be in the future testing high-energy windows?
High-efficiency windows, I guess. Yeah, I understand. Everybody's thinking about, well, should I put in better windows, or what window should I buy if I'm remodeling or doing a new home to get the best efficiency, the least heat loss? Kim Kleeman,
Amy,
do you not do that now?
We do. We are hugely focused on energy efficiency. When appliances or home parts, we do energy packages all the time. Not always with windows, but Amy, I will take back your request to our testers because it's about time that we do energy efficient windows again. We look at wind turbines. We look at a variety of heating systems to find out where are we going, where is our country going when it comes to energy efficiency, and are there products out there that are really doing well in that respect. You know, one thing that our readers love to find out about are the new light bulbs. If I had a light bulb story in every issue, I think our readers would just love me even more.
We'll talk about those. Amy, you're still with us. How do you use it? I mean, you want energy efficient windows, and Kim says they'll do that again soon. But no matter what you buy, you're going to it, and you're interpreting all those little red and black circles and dots with their half full and half empty and all the rest.
Absolutely.
Amy?
Absolutely. And I will not buy my windows until something comes out in Consumer Reports.
Wow. Okay.
Thank you, Amy.
Window Producers of America, there's something you can beg for. Beg for some for some gradations from Consumer Reports.
And Tom, let me tell you one thing. We call those little circles blobs. So now you know the real term for them.
Okay. That's very technical. I'll try and get my head around that. I mean, I have to admit, I've used Consumer Reports. It seems like everybody has one time or another. But you sort of demand that we come in and do some interpretation. You don't make it really, really obvious. Like, here's the top and here's number two and here's number three, at least the way I look at it. I spend hours looking at those blobs, Kim.
I hope you want to, but let me tell you that our magazine attracts people who are consummate researchers.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking today about 75 years of Consumer Reports about the things we use, we need, we buy. And we're taking your questions on how they do their testing and your questions on specific products or categories of product or consumption in general. We're going to talk later in the hour with a guest who says we are too much the consumer society. But for those who are right in the middle of it, many turn to the web, many turn to a magazine. There are lots of places you can look these days. Many have chosen this one. Joining us from Yonkers, New York, the editor-in-chief of Consumer Reports, Kimberly Kleeman. Lots of callers. Ashley in Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Ashley. You're on the air with Kim.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Kim. Thank you so much for taking my call. My question is, well, comment first. I've been an avid online consumer since my father first made me look at every possible car that I could afford when I was 16. But right now, I'm actually expecting my first baby.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And my husband and I have a web subscription, and we are completely at odds about the best stroller. So I was just wondering if you yourself have insider information or one that you would suggest. We don't want one of those big, bulky, travel systems, just something to get us to and fro with our little one down in the south.
Best stroller for pregnant Ashley and her husband. How do you go about deciding that? There's all these sort of like super Cadillac jobs I see out there now, Kim, that's, so souped up and they cost a zillion dollars. How do you decide what's best?
You know, the top traditional stroller, so we're not talking about super fancy, the top stroller on our list is a Consumer Reports Best Buy, which means it's also a good value in addition to being the best stroller performance-wise. Mm-hmm. And it's the Graco V4, V-I-E-4. It's $110. And it performs the best. It's easy to use. It's very maneuverable. It's safe. And that's what I would recommend if you want just a plain stroller.
And
now there are...
Mm-hmm. Yes, please. No, go ahead.
No, there are a couple other Graco models, but they're pricier and they perform a couple of points under the Graco V or Vi, however you say it.
Ashley, I hope that's helpful for your family. Tina's got a question here from our website, Kim. She says, is it right to say that Consumer Reports only passes judgments that fall in the middle of the road, her phrase there? That is to say, do you avoid evaluating, she says, really excellent products when those products cost above a certain amount of money judged average for the product category. What about that, Kim?
No, what we do is we are trying to be very conscious of the market so that many of the products we test are available to the mass market. We are always, however, looking for high-end products that might signal a fantastic technology that we might be seeing in other products. Likewise, in this long-term recession, we are also dipping down and looking at products that might be sold, let's say, in dollar stores or your big box store. So we're really trying to expand the range on the low end and on the high end to get an idea of you know, what is out there that the rest of us might be experiencing a little later. A good story about that is that, you know, pro style ranges have been all the rage for years and years. And so we routinely test, you know,
fancy kitchen range, like the commercial style, all that jazz.
Yes, and built-in refrigerators and all the rest. But we have found over the years that they perform poorer than products costing thousands of dollars less. They're, some of them are more repair prone. They don't clean up as well.
That's interesting.
So we get surprises sometimes when we look at the high end, which just goes to show that just because you're spending a lot of money doesn't mean you're necessarily getting a better product.
I still wonder, with Tina's question, in this era, especially the Occupy era, people are thinking about inequality. We've seen the middle class really in trouble. Was it easier for Consumer Reports back in the day when the great mass of Americans were buying from the same product set? Does it make your job harder, you know, after the middle class heyday, sadly, where we appear to be now, where price points are so spread out? Is it harder for you to put your shovel in and figure out where to do the bulk of your work?
You know, it makes our job more interesting when we have more to test from a variety of manufacturers, and each one is doing things a little bit differently. I think also, though, that one trend that we've been seeing over the decades is just an overload of information. So I like to think that our job is made more important when, where do I begin to look for the answer to this question? Consumer Reports tries to help people who are just overwhelmed with data.
Let's go to David in Arlington, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air with Editor-in-Chief of Consumer Reports, Kim Kleeman.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is another energy thing, and this relates to light bulbs.
Good.
We've all been replacing our incandescent bulbs with compact fluorescents for years now to save energy.
Mm-hmm.
Yet I find that these compact fluorescents are failing just as fast as the incandescents they replaced, because I made the habit years ago of turning off lights when I leave a room.
Right.
I think that there's got to be some information on which bulbs to deploy in which areas, and maybe what habits to cultivate to get the most value out of these things. I hate feeling like I'm spending more money for less light.
And David, these bulbs cost more as well. Kim Kleeman, what about it?
Yeah, absolutely. David, one of the things that that we suggest, and it sounds maybe a little over the top, but when you install a new compact fluorescent light, date it and make sure you save the receipt, because we are not finding a tremendous amount of failure before the bulb is supposed to go. But if you do, you need to take the bulb back and get it replaced for free, just on the principle of the thing. We are finding that CFLs are getting better over time. The first ones, you know, it took them a minute or so to reach full brightness. Now we're not seeing that much of a problem. There are still places in your home, like at the bottom of your cellar or at the bottom of a staircase, where you need immediate light and you're not going to wait around the 30 seconds it takes for a CFL to reach full brightness. So in that case, you might want to use a hybrid halogen bulb. The cost savings isn't as great as you would get with a CFL, but it gives you instant light. CFL bulbs are not perfect yet. We're just coming out with a test of 100-watt bulb replacements, and no CFL was exactly as good as a regular incandescent bulb.
And these are the bulbs that are going off the market in a week or so, right?
Well, actually, the deadline has been extended through later on in 2012,
okay,
which is good news, so that maybe CFLs by that time will catch up. But hybrid halogens will solve that problem, and they do meet the new energy guidelines, so that might be a way to go in the interim. room.
And what about habits of use, to David's question, with your compact fluorescents? If you're turning them off and on when you, you know, leave and enter a room, does that diminish their life?
It does. And we say that if you are going to be out of the room for less than about 10 minutes, you might want to keep your CFL on. But, you know, if you're going to be gone for 10 minutes or longer, you can definitely turn it off. And then, you know, as you return, turn it on. And it shouldn't lessen the lifetime of the bulb.
David, thanks for your call. Let's get one from Bethel, Vermont. Robert's calling. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Tom, what a great show.
Great to have you, Robert. What's on your mind?
Well, thank you. I wanted to ask Kim, with all the high-end cars these days, I was wondering if she's testing the new, like Lexus has a lot of the high-end cars have, I guess, meters that measure, look at the road ahead and adjust the headlamps. And here in Vermont, I find it incredibly annoying because they don't have their high beams on, but it seems like the technology isn't really, perfected yet. So there's a whole array of lighting on the highways that's, I think, should be just standardized. And the funny thing is, when I was dialing, Kim mentioned light bulbs, and I was down at my brother-in-law's lately. He's got one of those $100,000 Aldis, and he said it cost him $300 to replace one light bulb.
Wow.
In front of
Holy
his
cow.
Hey,
you know, Robert, I'm so glad you mentioned that. Stick with us for a second here, because this is a kind of pet peeve of mine. With a lot of these new bulbs, especially those kind of blue ones, they look like high beams when you're driving toward them, even if they're not. It may be great for the driver of that car, but for the oncoming traffic, I find it really irritating, Kim. Are you reviewing products, you know, for the guy sitting in the Lexus or the guy who's driving toward him?
We hope for everybody. Light bulb testing, or headlight testing, I should say, is something that we have been doing at our big auto test facility in Connecticut for many years now. And it's interesting because we test these things when there's no moon and there is wide variation in headlights. As you can imagine, auto safety has been a bread and butter, huge issue with us from the time that we started Consumer Reports. And we have noticed those kind of variations as well and are continuing to report on them. So thank you for bringing that up.
Well, do you get into these bigger issues, not what's just good for the consumer who's buying the thing, but what's good for the whole society? If we don't have good sort of standard ranges around headlights, that could be unsettling for drivers on the road. Do you, I don't know, express an opinion about that?
Oh, absolutely. And we recently did a story about a disturbing finding we were seeing as we reviewed cars, and that was the confusing controls. You know, driver distraction is in the news. Stop using your cell phones when you're driving. But equally confusing are some of the controls, the iDrives and the Ford My Touch that it used to take, you know, one or two presses of a button to change your radio channel or whatever. And now it's multi-step. Our engineers are taking, 11 to 15 seconds to do some of these, required things to, change the temperature or whatever. We think that is a huge problem, and we try to call that out whenever we see that.
Talk to us about the showdown, smackdown, I don't know what, that you had with Apple and the iPhone 4 last year. They came out with all the usual, the late Steve Jobs was still, doing his thing, and they came out with such a big hoopla about it. Everybody who loves Apple phones, thought about buying one or did buy one. And the next thing we know, here comes, 75-year-old Consumer Reports. We didn't know you were hipsters. And slams it and say the antenna's not working, and you got Steve Jobs on his knees apologizing.
You're talking about AntennaGate. So let me tell you that story from the Consumer Reports perspective. Mm. Okay, so we tested the iPhone 4. And by all standard measures, it was a great phone. The display was wonderful. The ease of use was wonderful. The voice quality was fine. Messaging was great. And then we started to see these user reviews online. Hey, when I'm in an area, a low signal area, and I happen to touch the phone in a certain place, covering its antenna, all of a sudden the signal dropped. So this is what we were hearing. So we decided to take the iPhone 4 back into the lab with the other phones that we were around at the time and tested what people were complaining about. And sure enough, we found that is true. When you are in an area of low signal strength and you covered the iPhone 4, It dropped calls. And none of the other cell phones that we tested did that.
So what happened? So, I mean, I know Steve Jobs said he was stunned and embarrassed. I mean, you had his attention. What happened?
Yeah. So for a limited time, and basically, so here is what we said. We said that, you know, for $200, we think the thing should work right. We knew in further testing that if you bought a cover, which they call a bumper, that made the problem go away. And Apple was offering free bumpers, but only for a limited time.
Okay.
And we thought that, you know what, if they offered the bumpers for anyone who had an iPhone or was going to buy this, maybe we would have recommended the phone then. But they didn't. And we don't think if you're going to pay that kind of money, you should have to go and buy a $20 bumper to make the product work right. And so we never did recommend the iPhone 4. But when the iPhone 4S came out pretty recently, they had fixed the antenna problem. And so we do recommend the iPhone 4S.
Well,
but it didn't work right. And you had to buy something else in order for you not to have that problem. And we think the consumer deserved better.
Let's go to Joel in Chamonix, New York. Joel, you're on the air.
Thank you. It's Chamonix, New York.
Chamonix, excuse me.
That's okay. And it's about 12 miles south of the St. Lawrence Seaway on the shores of Lake Ontario.
Brilliant. So happy to have you, Joel. What's your question?
Well, it's the question is, if I have to state a question rather than a statement.
Or however you like.
Is that when I go online and I want to research something, and by the way, I've been a subscriber since the 1960s, and the only reason I still don't have all my issues is that we once had a flood in our house and flushing in the basement, and they were
ruined. Oh, boy.
But other than that,
sorry.
When I go online and I want to research something, unless it's a recent product, you no longer have the information, or you used to be able to, it would show you that when I went online that it was in the archives and it would show you the year and the issue number so that you could look it up. And I don't think that's no longer available, and I wish you would have that back.
Everybody wants everything all the time now, and I can understand that, Joel, because you want it when you're ready to make a purchase. Kim, what about it?
Well,
you know, we do have archived copies of the magazine online. So, you know, I can investigate whether you're talking about you would like a really good index of, you know, years worth of refrigerator reviews, that kind of thing, or because we do have copies of the magazine online going back for years and years.
What do you say, Joel?
I understand if you're testing refrigerators now, you don't need to have an old one. But the last time you tested something, it should still be available, even if it was 5 or 10 years old, at least showing the year and the edition when it was out so that I could look at it. For example,
okay.
I was looking to test lead in water or lead in dishes or something like that. I couldn't find that. I don't know if you ever tested it. But it comes up. I'm a fanatic when it comes to research, and you have a great magazine, don't get me wrong, especially it was very helpful, your issue recently on health insurance companies, and I was able to help a friend get insurance when he didn't have any, and that was very helpful.
And talk about a product
oh,
that's not easy to compare, health insurance. Joel, I appreciate your call. Kim, you're brave enough to wade in even there.
Yeah, let me go back to his question because I just want to make sure that I understand it and you know help in resolving it if we have a problem there.
Joel's gone, Kim.
Oh, okay, sorry. So it sounds like for issues, he wants us to do a better job of, you know, even if it's 5 years ago when we last covered lead in water and stuff. So I have taken that to heart, and I thank you for that call.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about 75 years of consumer reports about the things we use, we need, we buy. And we're taking your questions on how they do their testing and your questions on specific products or categories of product. Kimberly Kleeman is with us. She is editor-in-chief of Consumer Reports. We're going to hear in just a few minutes from an un-consumer and even an anti-consumer. But we've got Kim with us for a few more minutes. We've got some comments here online. Kim, Sheena says, do you have women testing the vacuum cleaners? Preferably someone elderly like me who needs a truly light and preferably cordless vacuum. I've wasted so much money on buying top ones and never liked any of them. Who's doing the testing? Do you have Sheena's style testers out there, Kim?
We do. We have men and women testers for things, certain products, vacuums, can openers. We bring in people who can't lift a lot, or somebody maybe with arthritic fingers that can't otherwise, you know, that needs a very easy to use can opener. So we really try to test the product out on a variety of groups of people. We do all kinds of tests so we can say, hey, this one is heavier than most, or this one is lighter than most. And if you can't haul it, maybe this is the one for you. So yeah, we really try to keep in mind the huge number of people and different kinds of people who are going to be using products.
And how do you deal with people want to know everything? They want to know it now in the internet age. I mean, here's Denise. She says, slow cookers, !! All caps. Please do a review on slow cookers. I'm on my second one in 3 years. Help with 5! I mean, you can't review everything fresh every day, but people want it fresh every day.
You bring up a good point. I mean, our biggest challenge going forward is maintaining our relevance out there at a time when, you know, there are user reviews all over the place. And that's something that you alluded to before. So we have to make sure we are testing the products that people want. I love this show because I'm hearing, people's requests and I'm jotting them down to make sure that we're doing what they want. We have to do it as fast as possible. We're not just a monthly magazine. We don't test just in monthly batches anymore. Mm-hmm. As soon as something comes into our labs, we test it, we put it online, and we have to test far more than we used to because there's so much more out there, and we need to be in people's minds, and we need to have information no matter what they pick up and want to know about.
Here's another angle. Forgive me, but they're plowing in on us here. Eric says, biggest problem with Consumer Reports I've seen is going to the store only to find the model number is no longer available, and the retailer has no new follow-on model number. Very frustrating. I've run into this at least 3 times with kitchen appliances, fridge, microwave, oven. How do you keep tracking what product is now on the shelves and what's there and the model numbers? How do you do it?
Yeah, we have to make sure that we test enough products and give people an idea of, oh, if they don't have this, then this other one is a similar model. We don't do it perfectly 100% of the time. We are testing, though, probably double the products that we tested even 5 or 6 years ago. So we're trying to give people a bigger pool that if they don't have this one, they're going to have the next 17 on the list.
Kim Kleeman is editor-in-chief of Consumer Reports. Ruth is calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Ruth. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Okay, so here's my question. When we renovated our kitchen 10 years ago, we used Consumer Reports to vet all our appliance purchases.
Okay.
As it turns out, the stacking washer-dryer unit that we bought was a relatively new model to the market, and it was number one rated on Consumer Reports. That's the one that we bought. And after, you know, a certain amount of history and usage, that model turned out to have lots of problems. And that actually came out in Consumer Reports later. And in fact, there was even a class action suit involving this particular model of washer and dryer. So here we are kind of stuck with this lemon of a product that we used Consumer Reports to get our information for. So it's made me leery, I have to admit, and I wonder, like, how do you take into account the fact that a product is brand new and hasn't been tried and trued?
Kim?
First of all, I'm sorry about that, Ruth. That sounds frustrating, and I personally apologize. Let me tell you that as part of testing as quickly, as thoroughly, but as quickly as we can, and getting the information out there to consumers, we almost never do durability testing. That's because, you know, to keep it in the labs for 15 years until it conks out, I mean, you know, we would never get the information to you. We rely on reliability surveys. Many people know us just for our testing, but we send out millions and millions of consumer surveys every year asking people, what did you buy? And did anything go wrong?
But you can't do that for durability on a new product. That is a problem there, I guess, Ruth is
saying.
Well,
we are, like, we, Ruth might be one of the people that we ask about this washer dryer. And when we get enough responses from people about certain brands or even certain models, we put together reliability charts, and often they accompany our product tests. That is to say, you know, this brand might be top in our ratings, but we don't recommend it now because we just got information saying that it's unreliable, according to many of the readers who own it. So, it sounds like we didn't have reliability information on this new washer and dryer, and that's why we changed our tune once we got that information. You know, we didn't recommend it.
Watch your step there, Ruth. Oki says, yes, we have a problem with consumption, Kim. Says consumption is an archaic name for tuberculosis. The U.S. consumes 50% of the world's resources. Consumer Reports should take a wider scope to help the to help avoid the upcoming ecological social disaster. How do you balance these things? I mean, you're judging, you know, objects of consumer desire and attention and utility at the same time when some people are saying, boy, we can't consume this much, or we're going to consume ourselves right off the planet.
One thing about Consumer Reports is we are not pro-consumption. We are pro people having the information to make smart buying decisions. So I like to think that you know, we are in line with your next guest in that we don't care whether you buy anything. We want you to have the best information you can possibly get to help you make that decision. And if you buy a top-rated product and a reliable product, that's going to last you longer than you know, not using us and buying something that breaks and you have to replace it and whatnot. So I think it's helpful in that respect.
Dave in Stowe, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Dave.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Hi, Kim. Thanks so much for Consumer Reports as well. I've been a reader since the late 80s. I've been a subscriber. And I wanted to say that I totally agree. I'm a pretty serious environmentalist. I like to think of myself as one. And Consumer Reports has saved me tens of thousands of dollars. I have a car that's 19 years old that has almost 300,000 miles on it, the original clutch, and still gets better mileage than a Prius, and it's
wow.
a passenger Honda.
Wow.
So
yeah.
I look at that. That's saving me $3,000 a year in gas. And what that allowed me to do is I have solar panels on my roof. So I joke that the money I save from Consumer Reports allowed me to make better things like, you know, choices like that. And I was recently very pleased to find out you had launched, and I have supported your Greener Choices initiative, which I just looked up online. I had the name wrong. So I just wanted you to – I want to make a plug for that and hear you say something about that.
The Green Choices. Kim, thanks, Dave. Kim, how about it?
Yeah, Greener Choices is a website that we have where we look at labels and, you know, are these labels real? What green labels can you trust and what do they mean? And we know that that's important for our readers, so we are definitely going to continue that effort. We have a couple other new initiatives that I should mention because they're somewhat allied with Greener Choices. We have a big food safety initiative that we're starting. You know, certain donors are donating to us to help us launch that effort. And it's to really do more food safety testing. We just had an article in a recent issue about we did DNA testing of fish for the first time and found that about 10% of the fish was not as was claimed.
Yeah.
So you're going in and you're buying red snapper, but you're not really buying red snapper.
Right, we saw
some tested
of that. Our time is just so short. I got one last big question for you, and I'm sorry to come in there, but we're going to lose you in a second. Your editors and testers look at so many products over 75 years now. Are consumer products getting better, or with, you know, all the diverse sources out there, and they may not be well put together, or they may? I mean, is everything going to hell, or is what's the trend in product quality overall? Can you say?
I would say that products, as they become mature, as they are on the market for a longer period of time, they do get better. In 1956, we tested toasters, and we only had 3 out of 22 that performed well enough for us to recommend.
Wow.
Toast charred. It burned up. It flamed. The electrical cords could electrocute you.
We thought everything was better in 1950, that the toasters were made out of, you know, to
not
last
the toasters.
Forever.
So products are becoming better. That said, there are all kinds of new products on the market, and when new things are introduced or products have to suddenly meet new energy standards or other standards, they don't necessarily perform well, you know, at that outset. So we are always there trying to be the watchdog in the marketplace, and I think that has helped products get better.
Kimberly Kleeman, Editor-in-Chief of Consumer Reports. Stay good, stay sharp, stay in our corner, Kim. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
In a moment, the producer-director of the film Growth Busters says it's time for a U-turn in our consumer society. This is On Point. We've heard from Consumer Reports this hour. Now we'll hear from someone who says that we've put too high a premium on consumption, that it's time for a change. With us now from Colorado Springs is Dave Gardner. He's writer, director, and producer of the film Growth Busters, Hooked on Growth. On November 25th, so-called Black Friday this year, he urged Americans not to shop, saying, "We've got to convert our culture from 50-hour work week, six-digit incomes, trophy homes, and a new fine iPhone every year to a culture of sustainability, a culture of sufficiency, a culture that seeks and celebrates what really counts in life." In Colorado Springs, Dave Gardner, thanks for joining us. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Why are you making this appeal?
Well, first of all, repeat after me, Tom. I am not a consumer. I am a human being.
Hey, I say it every morning, just before I brush my teeth.
I believe you do. Well, the reason I'm making this point is that the Growthbusters movie is trying to raise awareness that a perpetually growing economy, which depends on ever-increasing consumption, is really not just impossible, but it's also ill-advised. And it turns out it hasn't even been providing happy, fulfilled lives for us.
So let's just start with where we've just been with our listeners, Consumer Reports. Are you glad it's out there helping people buy better quality products, or does it help fixate us on buying products in the first place?
Well, I really liked Kim's response to that question a few minutes ago, and your last caller, in fact, talking about how having information to, when you do have to consume, to buy higher quality products that perhaps have a smaller footprint, and especially products that are more durable and can last longer. That's certainly part of a good strategy of consuming less.
So where does this go? I mean, when you look at product countries coming up, you know, like China, they're always urged these days by other countries, certainly by the U.S., to have their citizens, their human beings, buy more things, because then they'll sort of sop up the products of their own factories and not offload them on the American consumers. Is there another model out there that really works?
Well, there are people exploring other models, but you know, you raise the real reason why we have got to have this conversation. You know, the planet just can't support 7 billion people working 40 or 50 hours a week and then spending those earnings consuming at a rapid clip in order to keep all 7 billion people working. So as the Chinese and then the Indians aspire to a North American lifestyle where we're, as it's already been mentioned, we're consuming way more than our share of the planet's resources, that's just not a workable model. We know that that can't work.
What's the alternative, Dave?
Well, the alternative is for us to shift our metrics. You know, depending on increased consumption, celebrating retail sales, GDP growth, celebrating the fact that more automobiles were manufactured and purchased, those all kind of work against us moving in a sustainable direction. So the first thing we've got to do is start measuring, real quality of life and life satisfaction, and stop putting so much emphasis on busy work, which is trashing the planet.
But how do you do that? I mean, human beings, you know, we want to be human, not just consumers. On the other hand, part of being human is invention and ingenuity. And when new products embody that, cool products, labor-saving devices, mind-expanding products, you know, human beings, it is obvious, I guess, want those things. They want to be part of that. How do you be sustainable and, you know, allow the human inventive spirit to express itself materially and not want to own or buy those things?
Well, the inventive spirit, I don't think it has to always be material. You know, I think our next wave of innovation is really going to be in the direction of discovering that it's okay to be satisfied with what you have.
You may be right, and we may need to devoutly hope for that, but ever since we chipped rocks into axes, we've been doing material innovation.
Well, you know, that's true, but, you know, we've really just been on this binge for the last 200 years, and until 200 years ago, we weren't doing that much damage to the planet. So, so fossil fuels and mass production and this obsession with gross domestic product, which really has only been around for about the last 60 years, those are the things that really work against us. And so I don't think it's completely in our DNA to self-destruct.
Let's hope not. Do you see evidence, Dave, that Americans are laying off the consumer pedal here or not?
Well, you know, the economic crisis is giving us signals, and a lot of us have no choice but to respond to those signals. So it's actually encouraging us to do the right thing. The economy is correcting because we had too much debt and too much spending, and now few of us can afford to spend at that level. Most of us can't get more debt, and so it's good. The fact that we're deleveraging and finding ways to borrow things instead of buy new things and to make the things that we have last longer, that's all part of a really good sustainable behavior pattern.
We'll see if there may be some self-correction built into the system. Dave Gardner is pushing for that and makes the case for it in his film, Growth Busters, Hooked on Growth. Producer, director, and writer of the film, joining us today from Colorado Springs, Colorado. Dave, thank you very much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and at On Point Radio. Be the first to find out tomorrow's topics and guests by going to our Facebook page, On Point Radio. Hit the like button and you'll get alerts on upcoming shows right there in your newsfeed. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Alina Mata, Alex Kingsbury, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.